Thanks for listening to Bear Soup. We have a fine show bubbling up for you this week in the Bear Soup Hot Tub. So listen up, bears. An introduction by Edward Lucy Smith in Chris Nelson's 1991 book, The Bear Cult. An article, Who's Goldilocks? International Bear Rendezvous. Shoutouts and the usual audio woof and nanny. We're locked and loaded, so stand back. You're just in time, Bear Soup. Welcome to Bear Soup, news, interviews, skews, and schmooze for the online Ursine community. This is your host, Ron Suresha, casting my pod to you through the mysterious tubes of the interweb from southeastern coastal Connecticut. You're listening to episode number 67 of the Bear Soup podcast, streaming online at bearradio.net, Mondays and Wednesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. Bear Soup is also available through our free iTunes subscription and download service. Access the Bear Soup archives through the Bear Soup tab on runsuresha.com. Bear Soup is sponsored by the Bookish Bears at Bare Bones Books. Check out their fine titles by Bear Authors at bearbonesbooks.com. The following is the first part of the introduction, written by Edward Lucy Smith in the classic collection of photographs from Bear Magazine, entitled The Bear Cult, photographs by Chris Nelson. The introduction is entitled The Cult of the Bear. Gay images and role models are supposedly fixed. What homosexual men like, admire, respond to, and fantasize about corresponds, according to received wisdom, with certain easily recognizable stereotypes. The blonde beach boy, the bodybuilder, the clone, and masculine dominant types in uniform or in leather. In fact, most of this is untrue. The images listed above are genuinely admired, but they were not always with us. In fact, they seem to have presented themselves sequentially in the course of the last 40 years. The majority were unknown to the homosexual mythology of the 1950s. Far from being immutable, homosexual role models and objects of desire are in a constant state of flux, to the confusion of the outside world and the homosexual community itself. This collection of photographs by Chris Nelson documents the emergence of a new kind of cult figure, the bear, the bearded, hairy, natural man. If one looks back to what now seems the infinitely remote epoch of the 1950s, one finds that the gay men of the time chiefly admired pretty boy types, with perhaps just a sprinkling of streetwise biker rebels modeled on James Dean. My source for this information is the magazines and photo sets offered by the gay physique studios of the time, which then, as now, flourished chiefly on the west coast of the United States. In the homosexual world, as elsewhere at that moment, facial hair was out of fashion. The naturally hairy kept not only their faces, but even their torsos closely shaven, at least for photographic purposes. The first sign of change in this attitude came with the sudden success of the so-called peplum movies, named by the French magazine Cahiers du Cinéma in honor of the abbreviated tunics usually worn by the leading actors. The first and most important of these films were Hercules, 1958, and Hercules Unchained, 1959. spectacular pop versions of Greek mythology. They were made in Italy and starred the American bodybuilder Steve Reeves, the most celebrated muscle man of the time. Reeves won the Mr. America title in 1947, Mr. World and Mr. Universe in 1948, and Mr. Universe again in 1950, after which he retired from competition. Going into movies was a natural progression, despite his almost total lack of acting ability, and the role of the powerful Greek demigod was tailor-made for him. The studios at Cinecittà in Rome had all the facilities for projects of this type. The movies did not take off, however, until they reached America. Hercules was picked up for American distribution by the shrewd impresario Joe Levine, who spent only $120,000 for the rights. He spent many times more than that on promotion, and the film and its successor became smash hits. A whole series of epic films followed, starring either Reeves himself or other American or British bodybuilders in the same mold. Photographs show that by the mid-1950s, Reeves was already experimenting with a beard. For the role of the legendary Greek strongman, facial hair was more or less obligatory, and both he and his rivals grew what was required. Their bodies remained shaven in accordance with established physique contest conventions. The only place where you might possibly get a glimpse of body hair in a typical peplum movie was on the torso of some lesser strongman, given a brief scene where he wrestled with and was finally vanquished by the hero. These films, with their lavish crowd and battle scenes but minimal plots, were only briefly popular. The vogue for them was more or less over by the mid-1960s. While they were always addressed to mainstream audiences, it was no secret even at the time that they had a special appeal for homosexuals. Studio publicity for Reeves and the other bodybuilder stars made a great point of emphasizing heterosexual orientation. Off-duty photos often showed the Hercules of the moment having his muscles fingered by some admiring female. The movies, nevertheless, remain camp classics to this day, essential to the story of the evolution of the gay sensibility, much less so to the history of the cinema. Peplum movies coincided, but had nothing to do with, the first stirrings of gay liberation. Gay liberation led homosexual men to reconsider the kind of image they presented to the world. Limp wrists and long hair came to be regarded as stereotypes imposed on homosexuals by hostile outsiders. It was essentially this which led to the birth of the so-called clone. On one occasion, after the homosexual community ran riot in San Francisco, protesting the light sentence given to the killer of Harvey Milk, newspapers stated that the protesters were recognizable as gay men because of their short hair and leather jackets. The phrase showed how rapidly perceptions had changed. It was also perhaps the last moment at which outsiders could feel sure that they knew what a typical homosexual looked like, even if the received image was now skewed almost 180 degrees from its point of origin. Within the homosexual community, and especially in cities where large numbers of gay men congregated, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, the 1970s were years of gleeful role-playing. Once away from his office, the young middle-class executive often assumed a new blue-collar identity which he took to the bars and other venues where he socialized. This persona may in some cases have been meant to allay his own doubts about his masculinity. It was also a statement about the kind of man who attracted him sexually. It was not by its very nature the adoption of a complete lifestyle. A better comparison is the concealing cloak and mask which 18th century Venetians put on for Carnival. More seriously committed were members of various specialized gay groups and subcultures who now began to assert their difference from the mass, even the homosexual mass. The most prominent and talked about of these were the group who were into S&M. They often expressed their orientation by wearing elaborate fantasy clothing, for the most part made of leather. Some of this clothing derived from standard biker gear, but much was specially made for fetish purposes. S&M soon attracted the attention of journalists and photographers. A typical publication of the late 1970s is the book Hardcore, with text by Michael Grumley and photographs by Ed Gallucci, published as a Dutton paperback in 1977. The text and accompanying pictures stress the fact that S&M attracts females as well as males and is a heterosexual as well as a homosexual activity. The men shown are often bearded and hairy-chested. They wear leather clothing, both standard bike gear and the fantasy garments made for strictly sexual purposes. Some situations have a blue-collar coding: a man with a pickup truck, a man with motorcycles, three men clustered round a pool table. Others offer a strange conflict of tastes and lifestyles. In one picture, a man wearing leather chaps and an elaborate cut-out leather jacket lolls on a cut velvet sofa in a stuffy living room. There are 19th century pot cupboards used as end tables, numerous bibelots, and a Tiffany lamp. A case of Architectural Digest meets the mineshaft. Similar photographs were taken by Robert Mapplethorpe, the most celebrated photographer to document the world of late 1970s S&M. One picture is so close to the image just described that one wonders if it was a deliberate imitation. Mapplethorpe's 1979 double portrait of Brian Ridley and Lyle Heater, slave and master, both in full regalia of leather and chains, shows them lounging in a room of exactly the same type, with the same scattering of bibelots and another elaborate lamp. Mapplethorpe became a victim of the disease, which was to change the face of the gay world, AIDS. AIDS turned every surviving homosexual male into just that, a survivor. People who surmount a catastrophe, even if precariously and with no particular certainty for the future, want to take stock. The euphoria of the years when everything seemed permitted and permissible was over by the mid-1980s. On the other hand, two decades during which many homosexuals had been out, identifiable without excuses to themselves and others, had been responsible for changes which were now irreversible. Anyone who recognized homosexuality as an integral part of himself also knew it was too late to retire into the closet and slam the door. Many of these homosexuals had never been happy with the still very constricted range of role models offered to them by the outside world, by their own kind, and above all by the gay press. Many had tastes and interests which had little to do with the accepted variants of the supposedly gay lifestyle. They were not necessarily young, nor in any stretch of the imagination pretty. Sexual attraction, in their view, was often a version of the daddy and son or buddy-buddy relationships. Quite a few could probably be described as good old boys who liked other good old boys, not just for company but for sex as well. It followed from this that they made little distinction between their sexual and their social selves. What you saw was what you got. As often happens on these occasions, the change of focus was made explicit by the appearance of a new publication, the San Francisco-based magazine Bear. Bear started life in 1987 as a pocket-format desktop publication, with a run of only a few hundred copies. It soon grew to quarto size and achieved a circulation of many thousands. Chris Nelson, under the working name Brahma Studio, was the photographer who supplied the majority of the pictures. It was these, inevitably, even more than the text, which defined the new image. Some of the photographs included in this book appeared first in the magazine. Others are different images of the same men. Between them, they offer a fresh definition of what it is to be a gay man. Some elements are obviously inherited from the S&M images of the late 1970s. Here are tattoos, nipple rings, boots, leather, though not many items of strictly fantasy clothing. There is still an affection for bars and bikes, yet the general tone is very different. In particular, there is no feeling of a bizarre clash between two sets of aspirations of the sort documented in the photographs by Gallucci and Mapplethorpe, which have been noted. Despite occasional adornments, these are primarily natural men, in almost every sense of that much-abused adjective. They are happy with the age they are. Some are not young. The age range is 20s to 50s. They do not conform to ideal canons of proportion. Most are hefty, however, and a good few obviously cherish their bellies. In this connection, one is reminded of the fact that an insistence on being slim is a Western fashion and, with the possible exception of the ancient Greeks, a 20th century one. In Africa, India, and the Pacific Islands, a certain amount of extra weight has traditionally been regarded as a sign of power and potency. With the advent of AIDS, similar attitudes may yet take root in the developed countries. In Africa itself, the colloquial name for the disease is slim. Nelson's pictures emphasize outward signs of maturity, in particular facial and body hair. They do so not only in order to express a rebellion against the aesthetic conventions associated with standard male nude photography. Basically, these insist that male bodies should be made to look as much like pieces of sculpture as possible, but so as to challenge social conventions as well. The ideas of Jean-Jacques Rousseau that civilization is at best a necessary evil are reprocessed. There is a challenge to aggressive feminism, which not only seeks female equality, but often tries to subject men to the tastes and standards imposed by women. To be a bear is to assert a homosexual masculinism which rejects this. One can even say that the male child here continues to revel in his own playful liberty. No, he will not come indoors at once and wash behind his ears, nor wash any other part of himself, for that matter. This collection of images is, nevertheless, also a series of social situations and relationships. Some pictures simply fill in the context of the new homo-masculine lifestyle. One, for instance, shows the leading bear bar in San Francisco, Lone Star Saloon, immediately after the 1989 earthquake, with loyal patrons gathered outside it. The building, as can be seen from the photograph, was heavily damaged, and the bar now flourishes at a different location. Where the men are nude, the interaction between the photographer and his model is always clearly depicted. Recent feminist doctrine has made a big thing about the exploitative nature of erotic photography, even where the eroticism is in fact very mild. The idea is that women who allow themselves to be shown nude or semi-nude are also permitting themselves to be controlled and thus treated as a species of property, subject to male use. Valiant attempts are sometimes made to apply this doctrine to photographs of men made by men for men. If the models are young, the enterprise is said to smack of pedophilia. If there is a stress on racial difference, as in Robert Mapplethorpe's pictures of black males, the fantasy is the unacceptable one of master and slave. In either case, control and exploitation are again the issues. The men in Nelson's photographs do not seem subservient either to the photographer himself or to the spectator. They are self-possessed, not bothered to be where they are, nor doing what they do. Apart from this, they show a wide variety of moods: aggressive, tranquil, mocking, apparently flirtatious. It is obvious that one widely shared emotion is a sense of self-discovery. They are making a public avowal of their own sexuality, and they are also demonstrating a willingness to share feelings, fantasies, and, in imagination at least, even their bodies with a wide audience of other men who share their sexual attitudes. As must be obvious, they are not professional models. In this context, a model can be defined as someone who earns a living from his or her looks, either clothed or naked, especially as they are recorded by the camera. Most of the men seen here have never done a photo session before, though some were already well known to the photographer. Others came into contact with him by different routes, for example, because they were readers of Bear. In each case, what we get is not only the record of a man's physique, but the impact of a personality. It is admittedly a personality viewed from a particular angle, the sexual one. It is also an idealization. The photographer's concern has been to give what he sees an extra dimension, a certain aura which explains the attraction of the cult, and tells us why these men have been selected as desirable. The basic attitudes and assumptions of our society make it easy for a mature man to admit to, and express, sexual desire for another person. It is much harder for him to accept that he himself can be the focus of desire. Basically, the admission that this is possible is what the photographs are about. The models show, inevitably, a degree of exhibitionism. More important, they also show a kind of courage, the quality which enables an individual to recognize himself for what he is and enact it for the camera, without fear or modesty. That was the introduction to the book The Bear Cult, written by Edward Lucy Smith, published 1991 by Gay Men's Press.
There's an interesting article that was published on February 19th, 2010. Who's Goldilocks? International Bear Rendezvous. Written by Trey Bundy. Published at sfgate.com, which is the online edition of the San Francisco Chronicle. You may have noticed a bunch of large, furry men running around San Francisco last weekend. They packed muni trains, piled onto shuttle buses, and spilled out of bars. They toured the Barbary Coast landmarks and held court in the downtown Park 55 Hotel. The bears were back in town. The occasion was the 16th Annual International Bear Rendezvous, a five-day convention for self-identified bears, typically denim, leather, or flannel-clad gay men with meat on their bones and hair on their faces and pretty much everywhere else. Just because you're queer, it doesn't mean you have to look like a sissy, says Chuck Rudd, president of Bears of San Francisco, the nonprofit organization that hosts the rendezvous. I know straight guys that if you throw a spider at them, they're sissies. We celebrate the hyper-masculine. During the past 20 years, the Bears have gone from fringe element of the gay community to a sex-positive global subculture. They're beer-in-the-shot kind of guys who might be just as comfortable fishing with buddies as dancing shirtless in a nightclub full of sweaty men. Bears fit into mainstream male activities quite well, says Stephen Wolf, editor-in-chief of Bear Magazine in Las Vegas. They might have more in common with their straight brothers than with their drag queen sisters. Today, bear clubs exist in almost every major city in the United States and most countries in Europe and South America. Australia and New Zealand have strong scenes, and there's been an explosion of bear-centric comic books out of Japan. Each year, more than 100 bear events take place worldwide. At the hotel on Saturday morning, the Bloody Mary mixer looks like a cast party for Where the Wild Things Are. A fair-sized chunk of the 600 bears at the hotel sip cocktails and mingle. IBR laminates hang from their necks and rest on their globular tummies. They're an affectionate and fun-loving crowd, bear-hugging, rubbing bellies, stroking beards, and planting kisses. The sign on a nearby women's restroom has been covered with a sheet of paper that reads, Men. While this year's Mr. Bear contestants roam around selling raffle tickets for charity, other bears, dressed in their Western best, line dance and two-step at the hanky dance. Still others hit club parties such as Bearacuda and Sunday Furry Sunday, pub crawling their way through the city to quench their thirst or cruise. Along with community, philanthropy, and relaxation, the International Bear Rendezvous is about sex. It's an environment where a sultry glance and the word woof are enough to cut through social formalities and get straight to the matter of one's desire. But sex alone doesn't sustain the volunteer force of 150 people that Bears of San Francisco employs to pull off the event. The goals of the convention are to bring bears together and raise money for agencies that support the gay and lesbian community, or those living with HIV and AIDS. To date, Bears of San Francisco has raised more than $500,000 for charitable organizations.
At play, bears look more like lumberjacks than they do CEOs. Some might work construction, but others are suit and tie guys during the week. Darwin Bebo, the convention's media coordinator, hazards a guess at why so many bears work in accounting or information technology. We're about the mind, not the body, says Bebo, a data analyst by day, so we might be more analytical. In some ways, though, the bears are the punk rockers of gay culture. Born out of a shared sense of alienation, the bears were a direct reaction to the dismissive judgment of the mainstream gay community. In the 1970s and 80s, the scene in San Francisco was ruled by Castro clones, or Twinkies, gym-toned young men with hairless bodies and magazine coiffures. Guys who looked as if they should be playing guitar in ZZ Top weren't considered objects of desire. We weren't the little, skinny, hairless boys that could walk around with no shirt and just a leather vest, Rudd says. We were tired of the nasty looks and comments, so we did our own thing. The resulting movement was an inversion of traditional concepts of masculinity and an eroticization of the blue-collar aesthetic. The Bears traced their roots back to 1971 in the formation of the Rainbow Motorcycle Club in San Francisco. The members, who were gay, sported denim, leather, and scruffy beards, which marked them as outsiders but also made them prototypes for the Bear movement. Over the coming decades, legions of men would fight to crack the stereotypes of gay desirability. I didn't feel I had to be one of those effeminate homosexuals to act on my gay interests, says Wolf. The Bear movement gives you that alternative. Acceptance. While it's difficult to pinpoint the moment when Bears first started to gain acceptance, Harry Litt, a renowned promoter of Bear events, zeroes in on the early years of AIDS, when beefy guys were thought by some to have avoided the disease. When people had some bulk on them, there was misguided common sense that they were healthy, says Litt, who lost a brother to AIDS in 1984. The early Bears spent much of the decade sharing a kind of crossover scene in the leather bars. In 1987, a Bear named Richard Bulger photocopied and distributed issue number 1 of Bear magazine, the first magazine of its kind. But still, few places existed where Bears were in vogue until 1989 and the opening of the Lone Star Saloon. Known globally today as Bear Bar USA, the Lone Star is widely considered to be the geographical point at which the Bear movement converged. Countless men claim the famous South of Market, Honky Tonk, as the site of life-changing revelations about identity and liberation. It was like Mecca for me, says Bill Coulter, who recently bought the Lone Star with business partners Tony Huerta and J.J. Beck. I was always body conscious. I have hair on my chest, hair on my back, but I really, really felt comfortable there. There's something really sexy about being who you are. The movement in San Francisco grew as Bear and Bear-friendly bars such as the Eagle Tavern and 440 Castro embraced it. Magazines such as Bear, now a glossy rag with mainstream distribution, 100% Beef magazine, and A Bear's Life magazine chronicled the scene. Bear clubs popped up on every continent but Antarctica, as did mega events, such as Litt's Lazy Bear Weekend in Guerneville. Bearadice. Lazy Bear Weekend is, in a word, Bearadice. A woodland, riverside retreat complete with sunshine, patio bars, and pool parties where hairy backs are considered hot. Over 14 summers, the event's draw has grown from a couple of hundred friends to several thousand bears. To date, Lazy Bear Weekend has raised $1.6 million for charity and helped turn Guerneville into a global getaway for gays and lesbians. But with progress comes change, which can be a little messy as a subculture matures and evolves. As the bears became more pervasive and a second generation emerged, they started coming in all shapes and sizes. Some were slim or muscle-bound, and some were even pretty. Subcategories developed, such as otters and cubs. Bear chasers, who didn't look like bears but were attracted to them, started coming around, and some bears weren't having it. All bears are not triple extra large and hairy, says Litt, quick to dismiss those who want only to preserve the old guard. Not all bears are sweet and playful and cuddly. Bear is not necessarily a look, it's a state of mind. Old pictures of big roly-poly guys, it's still a part of the community, but that's not all of it. Bear magazine began taking heat for exclusively featuring muscular, well-endowed models in its pages, iconic and fantastic, a la Playboy magazine. Meanwhile, 100% Beef and others remained focused on showing people with more realistic body types. Guys can be sexy and viable at all ages, sizes, and races, says Scott McGillivray, editor and co-publisher of 100% Beef. A lot of these guys felt self-conscious about taking their shirts off in public, so to pose for a centerfold, it opens their whole world up. Steve-O Harris, who edits A Bear's Life magazine, believes attempting to elucidate masculinity across cultures is a dead-end enterprise. The real definition of masculinity is that you have a penis, so I don't know, he says, laughing. But acceptance is the key to success and longevity in a society. If we shy away from that, we're going to lose sight of who we are and where we're going. As the Bears continue evolving amid the inevitable cattiness and posing that accompany any social movement, Litt offers a word of advice. For those who don't like the change that's happening right now, we don't want to turn into the people who shunned us, he says. Looking back as he looks forward, he's found a way to define the Bears for all time. If you're having a good time, you're a Bear. And this article,
Who's Goldilocks? Written by Trey Bundy.
Appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle. Music by the Mermen. Bearapalooza, starting April 15th in Hotlanta, featuring many of your favorite BearRadio.net artists. Thanks to Joe of BearRadio.net. Please send him some love at the website donation link at BearRadio.net. And as always, to my husband, Rocco. You've been listening to Bear Soup with your host, Ron Serratia. News, interviews, skews, and schmooze for the online Ursine community. Episode number 67. Check out the Bear Soup tab on my website, www.ronserratia.com. That's spelled R-O-N-S-U-R-E-S-H-A. Bubbles for the Bear Soup Hot Tub are powered by our sponsor, Bear Bones Books. Please check out their fine titles by Bear Authors at barebonesbooks.com. Look for Bear Soup and Bear Bones Books also on Facebook. And please feel free to email me at bearsoup@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, and remember, sometimes you eat the bear. Sometimes the bear eats you.